Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. Last week, I spoke with Paul Driscoll and Stephanie Pasquale about two federal programs designed to assist poor and low-income families with quality housing, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program and Section 8 Housing Vouchers. These two programs were the subject of a series of investigative reports on NPR and PBS's Frontline. You can find our conversation on the Campbell Conversation webpage at WRVO.org under the Local Programming tab. This week, we continue that conversation, and we look at other programs in the area that assist citizens struggling with housing in Syracuse. Paul Driscoll, again, is the commissioner of the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development for the City of Syracuse, and Stephanie Pasquale is the department's deputy commissioner focusing on neighborhood development in particular. And again, deputy commissioner and commissioner, welcome back to the program.
Great, thank you.
Stephanie, let me start with you. Other than the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program and Section 8 vouchers, what are the programs that are available to people living in Syracuse? And perhaps you can also speak, if you know, to what exists in Onondaga County more generally that help the poor and those maybe not necessarily poor but certainly struggling in terms of income to find and to live in quality housing. What else is out there?
Sure. Well, in our community, we also participate, as many do, in the federal continuum of care, which covers our housing vulnerable and homeless population. And there's approximately $9 million comes to this community for different programs that help support permanent housing options for different populations. Oftentimes, those dollars are specific to certain populations. In addition, you may have heard, you know, I think it was last year that the state announced that they're looking to redevelop 6,000 new units in 6 years, and I want to say it was $6 billion to help support permanent housing options for our most vulnerable in the community. So a lot of those programs, while part of it is the low-income housing tax credit that's in that sort of pot of funds, there's other funds available, particularly for the supportive services that sometimes are necessary for people to be successful in a permanent housing situation. So providing mental health services, substance abuse services, and a wide scope of others. Locally, we do receive the Community Development Block Grant, Home Investment Partnership. Those are entitlement grants that come to this community in which we do use those funds partially for services, but for the most part are for developing affordable housing. And those do go up to a slightly higher income level than the low-income housing tax credits we talked about. So we can go up to 80% of the area median income for those. And we try to also help families stay in place through home improvement funding and other property improvement programs. And we have some wonderful partners in town like Home Headquarters that help us administer those funds and get them in the hands as efficiently and effectively as possible. And you also may be familiar with public assistance that's available. Mm-hmm. And the difference between Section 8 support and public assistance often is the amount. So there are several thousand families that are on public assistance. There are lowest income families. The amount, though, that they have available to go toward housing is limited. And I think that's where we find a lot more of our transiency and mobility and lack of ability to stay in their homes and high eviction rates and that sort of thing. So that there's a lot of instability among our poorest families, and we're really trying to work hard to ameliorate that with lots of partners, including Onondaga County Department of Social Services and others, in order to address that.
And a lot of different pieces of this. I mean, you were talking about mental health assistance, and everything kind of fits together in that way. Now, the one thing also that's been in the news recently, and I was wondering whether it fits or how it fits into this puzzle one way or another, is the Syracuse Land Bank. And Mayor Minor put some additional funding for it in the city budget. The Common Council cut that funding. She vetoed the cut, and the council overrode her veto, as I understand it. So the program still exists. This was additional funding to go into it. But, Paul, does the land bank contribute to improving access to quality housing by the poor? And if so, how?
It does, in the sense that it brings quality units back on into the market. So the scenario is that the land bank is typically selling property at less than market rate in order to allow the buyer of the property to invest more money into fixing up the property. So the subsidy is kind of at the front end in the sales price. It's not affordable housing. We don't look at land bank property as official affordable mm-hmm. housing. But the land bank does have certain programs that if there is government funding involved in the rehab, and it is monitored by some level of government, state, local, or federal, that is considered affordable housing, and they're, like I said, they have a set-aside program for that. But generally speaking, most of the land bank sales are just market housing that are just sold at lower than market prices, so to allow the investor to make more investments in the house itself.
And as a way of a segue into the next topic I want to cover with the two of you, though, I suppose you could make the argument, though, that it contributes in a different way, which is, and I want to talk about this in a minute, but the importance of mixing different incomes together. This is, I guess, a house-by-house way of doing that, I suppose. If the idea is the house becomes fixed up and rehabilitated, and then perhaps someone lives there with a little bit higher income, able to take advantage of that, then some of the other folks on the street, you're beginning to kind of build the different incomes on a street in that way. Is that a fair argument to make? Or?
It is. And it speaks to the point about, you know, the city has an oversupply of housing, but an undersupply of quality housing. Mm-hmm. So people are living in, you know, substandard housing all over the city. And the land bank's goal is to add to the supply of quality housing through their enforcement mortgages that they put on these properties, which are basically holding the buyer of the property to make those improvements, or else the land bank will take the property back.
And in the same way, then, to go back and looking back at last week, that low-income housing tax credit kind of is the same ultimate philosophy, is to improve the quality of housing and provide incentives for it. The land bank kind of struck me as, a house-by-house mm-hmm. program that has the same underlying philosophy to it in some ways.
Right. And again, with the subsidy being in the sales price at the front end,
right.
Grants or tax credits to subsidize the rehab.
And I think site control is also key for those properties that, unfortunately, we aren't able to bring back. So we have properties where we need strategic demolition activity mm-hmm. because the condition of the property is, you know, necessitates demolition. And having that vehicle for site control has been critical to getting that one house on the block or several houses on in a concentrated area.
The one that's really sort of dragging down the block.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Pasquale and Paul Driscoll from the City of Syracuse's Department of Neighborhood and Business Development. Well, I wanted to go more deeply into this idea of the importance of the mix of different income levels of housing in any given area as opposed to large blocks of exclusively poor housing. Analysis after analysis has pointed to the importance of there being a mix of different kinds of housing. But as I'm sure both of you know, and you already mentioned it in the previous program, Syracuse has some of the most concentrated poverty in the nation by income and by race. And so segregated housing is obviously a feature of that problem. So I wanted to get a sense from the two of you who work with this on a daily basis. What's your sense of the importance of mixing different kinds of housing in a given area? And the bigger, harder question, I suppose, would be why and how did Syracuse's housing become so segregated over the years?
Federal housing policy? I think you're referencing the Rutgers professor concentration of poverty and men by race. And when I look at that study, it's frustrating in the sense that he is talking about the wider region and how the city is the vessel for the majority of low-income residents. It's not just the city itself. You have to look at it in the entire region. But focusing on the city, we have this legacy of being the first public housing area in the state. We're number one in the state. And that housing is not going anywhere. It doesn't move. So Census Tract 42, for example, just south of downtown, is almost completely public housing. And that will always be the case unless we de-densify that. And I know the Housing Authority, looking at the 81 project, is looking to do just that, you know, mm-hmm. take advantage of all the construction around 81 to de-densify that static population, that static built public housing that isn't going anywhere.
I had, just on that point, a couple months ago, I had Bill Simmons and Andrew Maxwell on the program talking about I-81 from that perspective of, here's an opportunity to really sort of shake that up and maybe break some of that concentration up. But go ahead.
No, that's just what it is. It's a huge once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to break some of that up. To your other point about just generally, as we move forward and bring new housing units online, historically, mixed-income housing through the low-income housing tax credit was very difficult to do upstate as opposed to downstate. And, you know, the economics of it all are pretty complicated, but really market-rate housing and low-income housing upstate are very close together in terms of, because we're a very affordable city, whereas in New York, you know, affordability truly means affordability compared to market rate down there. So it's difficult. The program itself, low-income housing tax credits, that is very difficult to, as it's structured right now, to provide mixed-income housing. Now, we talked a little bit about the Texas Supreme Court issue a couple years ago and how that has heightened the awareness in the state of New York to work more diligently on middle-income housing in these tax credit projects.
And we talked about that on the previous program last week, right?
Right, but it's still, you know, it's like steering a battleship. It's hard to do, you know, for both the state and the developer to truly incorporate mixed-income housing into one 50-unit tax credit project.
And Stephanie, what's your sense of the importance that this housing somehow find a way to get more mixed than it is to break up the concentration?
It's critically important, and we are operating in a regulatory environment that sometimes just doesn't allow for that. One of the entitlement grants I mentioned, the Home Investment Partnership, no matter where it is, folks have to be under 80% of the median income. So we've been trying to invest those projects in areas of opportunity that aren't in the urban core. To give people choice and opportunity, the low-income housing tax credits, as Paul mentioned, the regulations and the application process, it just sort of precludes really truly having mixed-income housing. Now, I know the state has a mixed-income housing component that we're doing our first project here on the north side of the city coming up with Housing Visions. And, you know, I think it's 5 units of the 50, 10% will be mixed income. But that's, you know, we need to do better.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Paul Driscoll and Stephanie Pasquale from the Syracuse City Department of Neighborhood and Business Development, and we're talking about low-income housing in the Syracuse area. Now, I want to come back to this problem we've mentioned several times in different ways, and that is the efforts to diversify housing, and one way to do that is to put some low-income or mixed-income housing into better-off areas. That often runs into very stiff local opposition. And again, the investigative reports on NPR and Frontline about the low-income housing tax credit program documented that. Paul, you've talked about that too. And I have to tell you, you know, I've seen this where I live. There was one project in particular that was being considered, and whether or not it was a good project and had thought through all the different implications is one thing. But the things that I heard, at least, being voiced as opposition were of concern, quite frankly. So Stephanie, how do you address that issue? How do you address that pushback that you're always going to get from better off areas when there's an effort that's subsidized in some way to try to diversify the housing in that area?
I think one of the things we've tried to do is really communicate this desire and this need with our counterparts in the county, and they've been open to, you know, thinking about how we can all participate and look at this at a regional level. It's not the city versus, you know, the outside of the city. What I've personally, you know, come up against is a lot of these projects have, you know, by design often have to be in a pretty small location, and zoning might preclude an apartment building from being in your neighborhood, for example, or for doing 52 units somehow scattered in your neighborhood, as acquisition and site control might preclude the project. It would be way too expensive to find 50 lots, for example, to construct that housing. So I there's a lot of parts that there's really not a huge incentive for a developer to look in when, to make the project any harder. So so I think that's where that comes in addition to, you know, neighborhood concerns and you know, the voices you probably heard in your neighborhood about not wanting a project of that nature in their area. But the truth of the matter is, our families deserve choice and they deserve to be located in areas of opportunity. So, you know, this is something we really need to address.
And you mentioned zoning. That leads me right into the next issue I wanted to bring up regarding this problem, which is, could government consolidation then, specifically zoning authority, help that problem by providing a more broad-based approach to planning and building? Would that be at least one lever that might be empowered by having a more consolidated governmental system at the county level?
If you're implying that consolidation means a countywide zoning, unified zoning map, that is an interesting proposition. Right now, like we said, there are 35 different municipalities within this county, each with their own zoning map. And so it's very difficult to navigate if you are a developer to go into different towns and understand what's allowed and what's not allowed. But to be honest with you, Grant, I never really thought about consolidation in terms of a countywide zoning map and its implications on the distribution of multifamily housing, for example. It's an interesting proposition.
Stephanie, any thoughts about that, the government consolidation, or how that might affect things?
I'm not sure. I think it would be a pretty long and involved process to figure out exactly how to do that. You may know, you know, we're undergoing our own citywide rezone process right now, and just knowing what I know about, in very limited basis on the complexities of addressing that, I know it would be a pretty complicated process. But I do believe, I'm not sure the consolidation would solve it. I think the idea is how we. The regulatory environment around these investments, there's a lot of control over how these dollars are spent. And if the state tomorrow said, we want all these projects in areas of opportunity, guess what? You know, things would change. So I'm not sure consolidation would address that as much as the dollars seem to be driving the decisions.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Stephanie Pasquale and Paul Driscoll. Well, in this last section, I want to get into perhaps what's the most difficult and sensitive area in all of this, and it's related to this problem that we've been discussing of efforts to diversify housing in terms of income and break up some of the segregation regarding poverty, income, and race as well. And it's something that you often hear in these discussions is the concern that the housing in the poorer neighborhoods, it's not as well maintained by the owners or the renters, possibly. And so if you bring more of this kind of housing in, you're going to lower the property values, or somehow having a mix is going to drag everybody down. You hear this over and over and over again, and it's driven by, I think, perceptions that people have about what low-income housing is like. I don't have a real succinct question that comes out of that, except, you know, how do we think about this? Is there a more constructive way to deal with that kind of conversation? What is the right approach to take here?
In terms of more equitable distribution of affordable housing throughout the county?
Well, how do you have that conversation with the county or even within the city? How do you have that conversation when that concern comes up? I mean, what is the response? Is that concern real? And then how do you deal with it if it is real? Or how do you have a conversation that takes people out of the assumptions that perhaps they shouldn't have?
Yeah, I think, you know, to step back and look at, you know, the need for affordable housing is more prevalent than most people think, especially, you know, looking at the renter population of the city. It doesn't matter what race you're in or what race you are. It's almost two or three-fourths of the renters in this town could benefit from, because of their income, from a public program, whether it's a voucher or affordable housing or low-income tax credits. So the need supersedes any race or ethnicity in terms of the need for – it's a housing crisis, not only in this area but nationwide. So I think, you know, we just need to get beyond kind of the stereotype that, oh, public housing or subsidized housing
is bad housing.
Yeah. It's more prevalent than most people think. And maybe that's, you know, the solution is to try to highlight the existing assisted housing or affordable housing governed by some form of government, and people begin to realize, wow, it is everywhere. It's more prevalent than most people think.
Stephanie, thoughts about that?
No.
Well, let me ask the two of you this then. All right. So we've had now conversation about the low-income housing tax credit program, Section 8 vouchers. We've looked at other things that the city is doing and trying to do. What is your sense of kind of where we are as a city and as a region here in surrounding the city in addressing these concerns, in providing housing? I don't know if it's a grade that you could give or another way in which you could kind of assess how are we doing? How you said crisis a minute ago, Paul, but where is Syracuse in this situation?
I think about the 18,000 households living in poverty in the city of Syracuse, and they're concentrated to some degree in our inner, more distressed neighborhoods right around downtown. But most of these households are working. It's either full time or part time. They're very industrious households. A lot of them are single parent households, but they're paying. The crisis is the amount of their income that they're paying towards housing. It's just beyond anything we've seen in the last 20 years.
And that's been going up for everyone. I've seen statistics on this that even at the upper incomes, the proportion that goes to their housing has gone up. Stephanie, where do you think we are? How are we doing?
I just want to – that was a great point, Paul. I wanted to bring up that, the United Way recently released their ALICE study, which I believe stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed for ALICE, that there are so many families that are working and they're just not making ends meet, that the two jobs stitched together aren't able to provide a stable enough foundation. I think this oversupply of housing is a real issue, that we have families that are very mobile. We have very high eviction rates here. And I think what we've been focused on is if we can have some more comprehensive efforts to stabilize quality housing or to improve the condition of our housing, less mobility will lead to, greater childhood stability, better educational outcomes, and just overall improved, conditions for our neighborhoods and hopefully increased investment. So the land bank we mentioned and some of these other strategies are to try to bring online as many quality properties as possible while taking offline those properties that aren't going to be put into productive use.
Well, it's a huge and complicated problem, and there's more to say about it, but we'll have to leave it there. That was Paul Driscoll and Stephanie Pasquale. Again, you can find our earlier conversation on the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program and Section 8 Housing Vouchers on the Campbell Conversation webpage at wrvo.org under the Local Programming tab. Paul and Stephanie, I want to thank you again very much for taking the time to talk with me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.